Thank you, Paul. So as Fiona said at the start of our service, we are exploring a series of themes in Lent around the theme of hope. And hopefully, there we go. The overall series we're calling The Way of Jesus to Enduring Hope. And in particular, but not exclusively, we'll be focusing on Luke's Gospel, which is the focus for this year. Last week we saw Paul talking in Romans chapter 10 about the availability of the gospel. You didn't have to climb high mountains and go on great treks or otherwise to find the wisdom and truth and the way of life. You don't need to go into great sea journeys or don't need to go and explore the most extraordinary areas. Paul said it's right there in front of us. And he has a name, Jesus. So it is to Jesus now that we're going to focus for our journey and following that footsteps that we are seeking to follow, both personally and as a church, are the footsteps that Jesus himself followed. However, our readings from Luke 13 this week does require a little bit of a background story, a bit of a context behind it. So sometimes when I do a bit of ancient history, some people love it, others doze off for the next 5 minutes. If you want to doze for the next 5 minutes, the world will continue on regardless. However, let me just explain a little bit of the background that we have. Anyone here been to Rome and the Roman Forum? And you would have seen the amazing Trajan's Column at the center, which is just as it appears these days on the left-hand side. And if you go up close on that top right corner, you'll see just incredible detail as these about 300 meters of graphics are wound up the column, and they all tell a story. The bottom right corner is actually how it would have been when Trajan initiated it. It was painted with coloured, and it would have been an incredible narrative to follow. And it's got pictures of building projects, about foreign nations, about wars and battles, all sorts of things that came around the Emperor Trajan, who came much later in the first century, but not far from the time of Luke. So when Luke is writing his gospel, these events that Trajan celebrates in his column are happening in that world. So we need to sort of recognize that this is the world that Luke is speaking into as he crafts his narrative about Jesus. And as I've been exploring and touching on a few times in our series in recent weeks, is that we look at the world of the first century and the world of the 21st century, while in many ways things are different, the clothing is different, and but there's a lot of similarities around the world of the first century, dominated by strong males, usually military figures, talking about power, giving all sorts of promises about peace and security and prosperity. If you just are loyal to me, but if you're not loyal to me, then shame and horror will be descend upon you. Is not that different to our 21st century world at the present time. And I think it's helpful for us in this time of Lent not just to follow the footsteps of Jesus to Jerusalem as a historical exercise, but to realise that the world in which Jesus was entering into is very much the same world that we experience, albeit with different clothing and different toys to play with. So, and against that background, we also need to see that the world of Jesus was totally enmeshed in these the same culture of leadership. Not the emperors as much, although the emperor was certainly front and centre, but the family, the dynasty of Herod the Great. And yes, it's a complicated family tree. Herod had at least 8 wives that we know of, and a couple more that aren't named, but we do know in the midst. Had 5 sons, and I think about 6 or 8 daughters as well across those 8 different wives. And within the family, you know, if you think succession was an incredible story about dynastic change, Herod the Great killed 3 of his oldest sons in his final years before he died because he had suspicions about them, and so on. So there were incredible family rivalries going on amongst the family of the Herods. I'm not going to try and unpack all that. I'll give you a simplified version, which is this one, so far as our story is significant. So Herod the Great was the king, and he was the king at the will of the Romans at the time of Jesus' birth. So he's the one known about how he was seeking to kill all the boys under the age of two. And as I say, he didn't just stop there. He's actually killing some of his own sons as well. He was actually very paranoid as he got older. Amongst the sons that he had, the ones that are significant for us, Archelaus, Herod Antipas, who's the focus of the Herod that Jesus is responding to in our passage today. When they said Herod is looking to kill you, it's Herod Antipas, the youngest of the sons, who refers there. And then we come down a line, the next line down, you see the next generation had a Herod Agrippa. And he's the Herod who appears in the narrative in Acts of the Apostles. And then right at the end of Acts of the Apostles, there's another Herod, Herod Agrippa II, who comes in the final chapters of Acts. So, yes, it's complicated. Now, when you see the word Herod, that is a whole dynasty. It's a bit like, no, I won't suggest it. Too many names come to mind. But a dynastic that was all-powerful and had a whole dynamic within it. Of significance to us also is the figure of Herodias. So if you look at the Herod Antipas, who's the Herod that we're looking at, down the line below it is Herodias. And the word Herodias actually means hero. So it's a pretty humble title to name your family. Herodias is a niece to both Herod Antipas and to Philip. Just take a note of that. She's also one of the grandchildren of Herod the Great. She initially married Philip, Herod, her uncle, and was based in Rome. They're all educated in Rome. They're all there at the will of the Romans, so they're well connected within the Roman world. Herod Antipas came to stay with them in Rome, fell in love with Herodias, even though he was presently married to a neighbouring king's daughter, decided to divorce her, which didn't go down with the neighbouring king particularly well. Philip agreed to divorce Herodias, and then Herod Antipas took up with his niece, Herod's granddaughter, Herodias, which was causing a bit of a scandal. And John the Baptist in particular was speaking against it, saying, you think this is righteous living, you think this is the way in which God intends us to go. Hence, Herodias was the one who got her daughter Salome to do the dance that saw the beheading of John the Baptist. So the world in which Jesus was mixing was not a pleasant place, and it was totally part of this messy power, politics, connections, intrigue, are you in, are you out, with the all-powerful figures. So it sets something of the backdrop for our story today. Now, after Herod the Great died, the King Herod, he left a late will. He had kept on revising his will. He had to, because he kept on killing off his sons who were going to receive the inheritance. So the latest version of the will was, he said, well, rather than having one kingdom, he divided up into four rules. And that's the one that was then taken. And this was disputed by the grandchild, Herod Agrippa, who actually wanted to grab the whole lot. So that's all lurking in the background. Okay, so the jewel in that area is Samaria, Judah, and Idumea, with Jerusalem and that coastal strip that around Caesarea and Joppa and so on. And that went to Archelaus. The northern area, the most Gentile area around Caesarea Philippi, right up towards the north, that's where Jesus was walking when he asked that question, who do you say that I am? That went to Herod Philip. And Herod Antipas, the Herod of our story, has Galilee and Perea, those two different sections on both the east and west bank of the Jordan up around Tiberias. And the building of Tiberias was his crown jewel. So that's the space that we're looking in. So if you just switched off the last 5 minutes, you can tune back in again. For those who don't, you can go and ask them, people who listen to questions. There'll be a test afterwards, you know. Okay. Not. Okay, so against that backdrop is Jesus seeking to introduce the work of the kingdom of God, the vision of God, an alternate way that was not dependent on the armies, the power brokers, the superpowers of the day or doing deals, but another way, the way of peace. So on that road to Caesarea Philippi, Jesus asked the questions. That's the big turning point in both Mark, Matthew and Luke. Who do people say that I am? Jesus stops on the road. Peter gives the answer. You are the Messiah, the one sent from God. Jesus changes direction. And the question changes from who am I? Who do you think I am? To now you need to know what I have come to do. This is the nature of my mission. And you might recall that Peter, having feeling emboldened by the fact that he got the right answer for the hard quiz, who do I, people say that I am, you're the Christ, then took upon himself to give advice to Jesus, actually rebuked Jesus when Jesus started talking about being handed over and being beaten and of the difficulty it was to come. Peter took Jesus aside and said, Lord, you are the Messiah. Let me just remind you, the Messiah is like David. He's the one who wins the battles. He's the triumphal one. And remember those chilling words of Jesus to Peter in the hearing of the disciples. Get behind me, Satan. Unwillingly, unknowingly, Peter was actually offering Jesus exactly what Satan wanted, to step away from his mission. So that's the backdrop. So when we're talking about the way that we are seeking to follow, it is no small thing. The way of following Jesus in our world is not that different in many ways to what it was to stop and to follow Jesus in the first century. So we will be following the journey of Jesus to Jerusalem. And this is where Luke's gospel really features. There's a whole section, about 10 chapters in Luke, that you don't find in Matthew or in Mark. It starts in Luke chapter 9, verse 51, where he has an account of the journey of Jesus, saying, we are now heading to Jerusalem. And it goes runs right through to chapter 19, verse 44, when we have Jesus eventually arriving in Jerusalem. So in that context, this is what Luke is guiding us. At that time, approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. This was necessary. And it's against that backdrop that Jesus then teaches the nature of the kingdom that he's on about. So it's actually not 9:51. This is another verse. Someone can do a quick search for me. When Jesus went through the towns and villages, teaching as he made his way to Jerusalem. So in Luke's gospel, we have a lot of the parables are packed in this section. We've been encouraging, and I thought I had a copy in front of me, but it's moved. But we've got those copies of Luke's gospel that are available on the tables, on the Info Central table, and I'm really encouraging everyone to take a copy, whether it's that one and you can mark it, or whether you have your own copies at home. But for your Lenten journeys, for our Lenten journeys, let's at the very least read Luke's gospel. But if in particular, I would suggest maybe read from verse Luke 9:51, go back one, to 19:44. Maybe make that a goal for this Lent. So the whole idea of giving things up for Lent, by the way, isn't that there's a benefit in doing without chocolates for a period of Lent or whatever else, or whatever you choose to do. It's actually not the value of giving up as though that's worthy. It's giving up whatever it would is the blockage to doing this type of thing, of some spiritual exercise, so we can give our full attention, our full focus to what it means to say yes to following Jesus. Immediately before our passage this morning from Luke 13, we pick it up in verse 31, but immediately before, Luke tells us about the saying of Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Those who are following, make every effort to enter through the narrow door, because many, I tell you, will try to enter and will not be able to do so." In other words, if you are looking to bring all your baggage, all your goods and all your hopes and dreams with you, you're going to need to have a pretty big door. And I spoke to some new neighbours in Clayton Bay yesterday, a lovely new couple just moved in over the road. But they did have something which I hadn't realised was a thing, but they had purchased the house over the road as is, fully finished. Literally, the old owners just stepped out, including a significant yacht, which was waved in front of my eyes. Was I interested in having a significant yacht? I exercised self-discipline. I could see all the dollar signs going up because that yacht needed significant work. But if you're going to have all that baggage with you, you're going to need a bigger door. Jesus is saying, you can't make this plus bring everything else that you want to cram into your life at the same time. There's a phrase which I love to use, one of my favourite phrases, and there's an appropriate way to say it and there's an inappropriate way to say it. But I love to say it, too easy. You know, someone asks something of you, you can do it, too easy, we can do it. Like that phrase? Jesus doesn't want us to be sucked into thinking, saying yes to Jesus and going his way is just going to be all easy. There are occasions in which some things in life are too easy, like signing up to various things and you just click this button here, tick this box here, you're signed up, too easy. Enter into this contract for some sort of financial arrangement or whatever else, too easy. Go into one of our big stores and you look at an item, you know, you just see it and it's such a good deal. And the salespersons are not going to come up to you, "Oh, no, it's going to be pretty hard, I reckon." The salespeople are going to come up and saying, "Yes, you're right, it's a unique item. This is a moment, you can do it, and I can provide you all that you need to do it. Just sign up here, click here, too easy." Jesus is saying that to follow Christ, do not be under any illusion that life just becomes a cruise thereafter. It is costly. It is worth it, Jesus said. If you want to hold on to the whole world but lose your life, that's a choice you can make. Or if you're willing to set aside your desires for this, trying to gain the whole world and follow Christ, then you will gain life. So we come to the passage that we looked at, that Paul read for us. At that time, some Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, "Leave this place and go somewhere else. Herod wants to kill you." Now, we are accustomed when we hear the word Pharisees, we think suspiciously, "Oh, there's some plot going on." This seems to be some good-willed Pharisees who are aware of some of the plots and plans for Jesus and are encouraging him to avoid it. This is a good risk avoidance strategy. And actually, it is a matter of historical fact that the vast majority of Jews who turned to follow Jesus came from the background of the Pharisees. So we shouldn't put the Pharisees up in totally in that negative space. The leaders had more to lose than many others. So some Pharisees came to Jesus, said to him, "Leave this place, go somewhere else. Herod wants to kill you." Jesus replied, "Go tell that fox, I will keep out driving out demons and healing people today and tomorrow and the third day. I will reach my goal." Now, the language of the fox is a political term. A fox is cunning, it's wily, but it is not a lion. It's not the strongest in the forest, and they're not usually welcomed. You don't make many foxes as pets that I'm aware of. The only foxes that I've seen that I would enter into my house was a soft fox as a soft toy, which a friend of ours once had. But, you know, foxes you view with suspicion. They're usually up to no good. This is Herod Antipas. he's talking about. Now married to his wife's former wife, sorry, his brother's former wife, his niece, Herod's granddaughter. And Jesus is, he knows it. Tell that fox, I will keep him on. But in particular, I will reach my goal. There's a direction to what Jesus is doing. And he will reach that goal. Not be driven by fear. He goes on. In any case, I must. And the phrase is actually used, it is necessary to press on today and tomorrow and the next day. This is the work of the kingdom. For surely no prophet can die outside Jerusalem. One little note for those who like the significant details. Whenever this little phrase is used, henna in the Greek, it is necessary, it points to something that is necessary for God's purposes. It's what's called a divine must, the divine imperative. This, if to be fulfill what God is asking, this is necessary. There is no other way. You might remember that in the background, Peter talking about rebuking Jesus and saying, no, you don't need to be handed over and beaten and to die. You're to be like David, be a success. Get behind me, Satan. Jesus' response was, no, that is not the way of God. That's the way of Satan. Here, with the best of intentions of these Pharisees saying, you're better off avoiding Jerusalem because it's going to be dangerous and there's plots to capture you and to kill you. Jesus' answer is the same. I must. And it goes a full arc through to the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus is standing at that moment before his arrest, before the cross, and he prays to the Father, if there's any other way, Father, nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. This necessity is driving the narrative if this kingdom is to be established. The way of avoidance is not the way of the kingdom. Now, I don't have a go at risk registers and things like that. I've been on too many boards and things over the years. I know risk registers and all the colour coding and the lights and all the different grades inside and outside and all those types of things. Anyone involved in business, you need to know it. Anyone involved in appropriate responsible governance, you need to know all about risk. But Jesus is saying, do not pretend for a moment that to follow Jesus is without risk. It is stepping into risk because that is precisely where Jesus said it was necessary for him to go. And it does translate into us as a church. Not just us, but any churches. Churches that are seeking to avoid any and all risk and want to have certainty, want to have all the plans nailed down and all the, you know, things locked up, is not the way of the kingdom. Entering into a space of risk is actually part of the path of discipleship, of being a part of the mission and ministry of God. And I do believe that is something of the space we are in at St. Matthew's at the present time. The choices we make do involve risk. It's an appropriate question to ask, but it's not always answered by a risk register. It's answered by prayer and discernment of believing, is this a pathway, a step that God calls us to go? Jesus continues in Luke's account as he anticipates and looks at the goal, this destination for his journey, Jerusalem to Jerusalem, the heart of the kingdom of Israel. You who kill the prophets and stone those who sent to you, how often I've longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. Now, there is I'm not sure irony is quite the right word for it, but it's pretty close to it. Luke is writing his gospel, I believe, most likely after the fall of Jerusalem. They had actually rebelled against the Roman rule. Trajan was involved and they actually held out until there was a devastation of Jerusalem. Certainly, the first generation hearing Luke's gospel knew that Jerusalem was in ruins. So as they hear this, and we're asking the question, wow, we didn't see that coming, they will go back to the words of Jesus, the words of the prophets. So if you seek to do it your way, then that is not the way of God. So Jesus, again, is indicating that there is a willfulness behind this. And the way in which Luke writes it, I'm not going to labour it, but he actually uses the word four times, the will. Jesus sets his will on the journey to Jerusalem. There is the will of Herod to kill Jesus. And then there is the will of those who are not willing to take the cost of following Jesus. As the journey continues, you can see that it's not an easy journey, but it's a journey of God in that space. So as a summary, we can note, just in this brief episode, that journey to Jerusalem for Jesus and his followers was a journey into a political, religious, and spiritual storm, of which Jesus was fully aware. You know, I like lots of things about Jesus Christ Superstar for the younger generation. That was actually it was a thing back in the day. I'm guessing most of us are fairly familiar with Jesus Christ Superstar, just a guess. There's some great moments in it, but it actually portrays Jesus, who was this naive person caught up into the politics of the day and crushed between the powers that be in Jerusalem. Jesus wasn't naive. He knew exactly where he was going. He was prepared to call it out, as he did against Herod. But he would not be prevented from the work of the kingdom. So too is the way for those who would follow Jesus. So the world of the first century and the world of the 21st century, what does it mean for us to have a Lenten journey in following the way of Jesus? The faces may change, the powers might change dress, the size of the toys get bigger and bigger, but the call is the same. I want to finish with this lovely quote from Corrie ten Boom, and boy, was she someone who knew what it was to get caught up into the politics and the powers and the militarism of the day. Corrie ten Boom, if you don't know anything about her, do a Google search, you find a lot of stuff there. But I love this quote of Corrie ten Boom. Never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God. As we look to step through doorways that we believe God is opening before us, unsure just what lies ahead, never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God. Amen.